For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We are going to spend the next couple of months together tracking through a section of the book of Romans, chapters 1 to 8, that we're calling From Tragedy to Triumph. And if you're like me, when I was a little kid, I hated to read. And so my mom, who loves to read, would bring to our house Reader's Digest condensed books. Does that sound familiar? Okay, Romans chapters 1 through 8 is the Reader's Digest condensed version of the Bible. It is really the core message of what the Bible is. And so I'm saving you countless hours to just bring to you this study over the next few weeks. So there you go. If you're lazy, you'll love it. 2 weeks ago, we began our study talking about the tragedy side of things. Because as Paul says in chapter 1, verse 16, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, both to the Jews and to the Gentiles. So the whole thing is about good news. But that good news focuses on a salvaging effort that God is involved with in human history, and more broadly than human history, than the entire cosmos. That there is something tragically and deeply broken. And so the first chapter 1 through chapter 3, verse 20, it really lays out the central problem of humankind. And we talked about that last time. We talked about how God delivered over to humanity the freedom to pursue their own way, knowing where ultimately this would end up. It reminds me a lot of Jesus' story of the prodigal son. And you remember, the son comes to the father and he demands of him, I'm of age, I want my inheritance, it's my right, I want it now. And so, of course, his father, knowing where this would lead, nonetheless honored his request and said, there it is. And just the anguish of seeing that son walk away with a stewardship that he had not the maturity or the ability to really manage, and it just kind of destroyed his life. And in sort of a window into what's wrong with humanity, we've demanded our freedom to go our own way. But we're not free with respect to the consequences of our choices. And so as we drift further and further out of God's orbit and further into our own agenda, we just find that we are crushed on the anvil of life. And so we are a very broken humanity, and each of our lives in various ways kind of reflects the brokenness of humanity in general. Well, this morning we want to complete that picture of the tragedy of the human situation. Then next week and the weeks after, we're going to pick up in chapter 3, verse 21 through chapter 5, verse 10, and talk about what does God do about the tragedy of the human condition? What's God's response to that? How does he do what we cannot do for ourselves? And that section ends with this incredible picture of peace with God. And then in chapter 6, verse 1 through chapter 8, verse 39, just the incredible triumph of the work of God, transforming the lives of broken people into whole people, taking a broken creation and restoring it to its original intent. And so it's an incredible picture, a beautiful picture, and it all kind of just fits together. That's the story of Romans chapters 1 to 8. So what we're saying here is that it's all way worse and vastly greater than anyone could imagine. That's what we're saying. That's the story that we're unfolding here. And we want to pick it up then in chapter 2, verse 1, where we talk about this principle of accountability. He says, every mouth will be closed and all the world will be accountable to God. That's the summary statement that Paul makes at the end of this section that begins in chapter 2, verse 1 and ends right here. Every mouth will be closed and the world will be accountable to God. And then again he says in Romans 14, each one of us will give an account of himself to God. What does this mean? The word just means hupodikos just means to give an answer. And usually that's put in a courtroom environment, a court context. So here's the charge against you. What do you say about that? What's your account of the events? And so this is then weighed against the reality of the situation that is being discussed. And so what Paul is saying here, and what the whole Bible teaches, is that there is coming a time in which you and I and everyone who has been or ever will come before God to give an account. And so I want to think about that with you here this morning, because that's what this whole section of the scripture is about. I want to think about it from a couple of perspectives. First, I think that this idea of being accountable to anyone in our culture is a really unsavory thought. We live in a culture that says, I'm accountable to me and to me alone. And the Bible's saying, well, okay, yeah, but so there's this person called God, who is in fact your creator and to whom you are ultimately accountable. And so we want to unpack this question, well, what if there is no accountability? And then secondly, importantly, and right into our passage, is this question, on what grounds must I give account to God for my life? So those are the two things that we're going to jump into here this morning, and we'll begin with the first question, what if there is no accountability? Michael Crichton is one of my favorite writers. I love his work. You know, Jurassic Park is sort of a classic, and he's done so many great things. One of his earlier works is called Westworld. How many people have seen Westworld? Awesome. You should all go out and watch Westworld. Because why? Because it's complex, but one of the key themes that drives this is the thing that sort of calls to all human beings, this desire for total freedom and a complete lack of any kind of accountability. He envisions a futuristic world called Westworld, which is set up like an old Western-style town and inhabited by stunningly human-like robots. So they're not people in the same sense, but they look like and act like humans in every other respect. But you can treat them as objects because that's what they are. And so in Westworld, you can go and you can have whatever sexual encounters you want without worrying about the consequences on any level. You may find that it would just be thrilling for you to get into an old style gun battle, and you can go kill people and go ahead and do that and just walk away. And when your vacation's over, you put your guns up and you go back to work. Say hi to the wife. Haven't seen you for a while. Well, of course, Creighton's point is that this is not without consequence, but it does. But the attraction of it is that it just fits into this picture that we would just love to do with our lives whatever we want and not feel that we're in any way accountable for the things that we do. Well, let's probe into that just a little bit. We wonder, you know, if there is no ultimate accountability for who we are, or for humanity more generally, what kind of universe is this? Clearly, it is a universe in which there is no justice, because justice requires an answer for the offenses that people have done to the world around them. How would it have gone down after World War II and the senseless slaughter of 6 million innocent Jewish people in Europe to not have the Nuremberg trials? Just to say, well, boys will be boys, it's time to move on. You know, there would be an awful lot of people who lived in the aftermath of that would just feel that here is something that can never heal because it was never addressed, and they would be right about that. We wonder, what would an eternity be like among permanently unchanged people? People who are never brought into account for what they've done, what their life is about, who they are. There is a word, actually, that we commonly use for such a situation in which the Bible describes as well. You know what that word is? Hell. That's a forever living, unaccountably, according to your own devices, with an eternity just to uncover who you really are at the core. and to have to be unchanged forever, to be in an environment with people who forever live with all the faults and limitations and brokenness that we've been talking about here forever. That's hell. And we are to further ask, I wonder, what kind of God would this be that allows a universe like this to go on with all of the cruelty, with all the inhumanity, and with nothing at stake, apparently. The Nobel Prize-winning novelist Albert Camus, writing in the ashes of the Second World War in his novel The Plague, makes this point. He says, if God exists, he is the devil. Why does he say this? Because if there's no accountability at the end of the day, if justice is never served, then the one who is superintending this whole crapshoot must be evil, must find somehow that it makes sense in this twisted and distorted world to see all of the pain and the suffering that people have put themselves under and put other people under to no end and with no resolution. What kind of a being would do that? And I feel like, yeah, that does make quite a bit of sense. I think that that's exactly right. The whole concept of a just universe presumes accountability. The whole notion of moving into a situation where God rules and where the goodness of God is manifest presumes a time of accountability. And so that's what the Bible declares. And I think that that's basically, that makes sense. I can't imagine the alternative to that. But I want to probe a little bit more deeply into the second question, because this is really what our passage is all about. Namely, on what grounds must we give an account to God? And Paul, in dealing with this question, really is dealing with two very different kinds of populations. On the one hand, he's dealing with Jewish people who have a written record of their interaction with God over a couple thousand years by the time Paul is speaking to these Romans. God has revealed himself. Old Testament scripture has been written. They know a lot about what God expects and what kind of God there is. But he's also writing to a Gentile audience, a non-Jewish audience, people who don't have that same background, that same sort of understanding about the creator God of the universe and the uniqueness of humanity in his image and the moral requirements of God on his personal beings made in his image. And so in this chapter, chapter 2 and then into chapter 3, Paul engages both of these populations to talk about the accountability that all of us have before God. So beginning with the Gentile, he says in chapter 2, verse 14, when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having a law, are a law unto themselves, in that they show the work of the law written on their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts accusing or defending them. And so the focus here is on conscience, things that we do instinctively. And Paul is making the point that it doesn't matter what your cultural background are, where you are from, that there is something that all human beings, by virtue of their humanity, and regardless of their beliefs, simply know. Intuitively, instinctively. The word conscience is an interesting word. It means that there is such a thing as universal moral knowledge. Conscience is the word in the English that is rooted in Latin, but it's the same root in the Greek of the New Testament as well. The root word of conscience is scientia, which means knowledge. It's where we get the word science from. And Paul is saying here that there is an inner knowledge that all human beings possess, not learned from our environment, but by reflecting on ourselves to understand that we are able to apprehend, even at the earliest ages, the difference between right and wrong. And an understanding of where our actions stand in relation to right and wrong. That's the biblical view. And in our day, of course, that has been deeply challenged. The thought that there's anything universal about morality or about accountability has been more or less dashed on the rocks. We wonder, do cultures have their own moral truths? Because that's really what's being taught today. I cite here Margaret Mead's 1928 book, The Coming of Age in Samoa, as a decisive and definitive moment in Western thinking, modern Western thinking, because really she's reflecting ideas that are as old as the Greeks of the 5th century B.C. But Mead makes this point in going to Samoa that there are certain mores, certain ethical practices in Samoan civilization, Samoan culture, that is just different than what you see in the Judeo-Christian West and in other places around the world, and then draws the conclusion that since there are different mores from culture to culture, that people do things differently, therefore there can be no universal moral truths, and therefore ultimately no true accountability that humans have before God. Because why? Because all of our moral reasoning just emerges out of the culture in which we live and which has shaped us and molded us into its image. Does that sound familiar to you? That is how we think today. It's almost axiomatic that we think along those lines. And for that reason, then, we look at other cultures and we not as inferior or superior. We just say, that's the way they do it, and judge not. And so here, then, our own modern thinking is very much kind of in tension with this biblical narrative that we're describing of ultimate human accountability before a God who has objective moral standards upon which to assess and draw us into accountability. For most of the people, I think, in our culture, it's just sort of an odd afterthought, indeed, that there would be any sort of accountability whatsoever of a human being before any authority, including God himself. Because we have so fully embraced this kind of anthropological relativistic view of moral truth. But I think it's important for us to kind of take this on just a little bit too and to think about it more critically. Because is it really the case that just because certain cultures have practices that are different than other cultures that we can conclude, well, then what must be true in one culture would be not true in another culture? In other words, that each culture has their own moral truth because they have different moral practices. Does that follow? Methinks not. Different, okay, is not necessarily okay. It's just different. So, some cultures practice female circumcision. Is that great for them? And abhorrent to us, or is it just plain wrong? Some cultures practice infanticide. If the child is not the gender that we're looking for, it's leave it out to die. Is that just okay for that culture, but not okay for ours? I don't think so. Is it okay for one culture to emerge with all the military might that it possesses and then go and try to liquidate ethnicities that are different from theirs, as happened in the ethnic cleansing campaigns in Europe after the Second World War? What about that? Is it different? Yes. Is it okay? It doesn't follow. So different doesn't just make it okay. It's possible to say it's different and it's distinctly bad. It's wrong. And intuitively, we all know that that's the case. Further, we would want to make a distinction between standards, facts, and priorities. In other words, okay, so there are certain things that people do that are different from one culture to another. That some people will call murder something that another culture wouldn't, for instance. But it's interesting when you get, when you probe down deeply into the thinking of the culture, you know, maybe cultures practice marriage according to different rules, different frameworks, but all cultures have a category for marriage and for marriage faithfulness. There are standards that we have in common, even if the historical circumstances of our cultures and the facts that have borne out from that have created different kinds of expressions of living according to really the same basic moral insight that it's wrong to steal, it's wrong to kill from people who are innocent and so forth. And what I think is really important for us, in even in our day, which is so diverse and so pluralistic, and where there are so many narratives about what's right and wrong and so forth, in our culture, that we really have far more in common with people than we realize. And I think that that's a really important point. We are in a place in our culture where people are choosing sides in this culture war mentality and building their barriers against one another, walling up their defenses against the others who they view as a threat. And the reality is that Christians are in a unique place to find real common ground with all people. Because we know that there are legitimate longings lost people have and an awareness deep within them of what's right and wrong, what is just and what's not. And we can touch base with that and we can begin to work through the issues that relate to the things that separate us and the things that we differ over. We can help people walk through the way that we prioritize our moral responsibilities and realize that at the end of the day, while yes, there are massive differences in our culture, there is also always a place to communicate because the standards that our own conscience tells us everywhere we go, whether that's West Africa or East Africa or Latin America or Central Ohio, it is always the same. Deeply, at a deep level, on a level of basic moral principle, there is substantial agreement across cultures. There isn't a culture that would say of this person who killed 10 and injured nearly 30 in less than a minute in Dayton last night, good job. Oh, it'd be abhorrent to all people in all places and at all times. And then lastly, and I think pertinently on this point, is that the fact is that without real universal moral awareness, conscience, it devolves human interaction to a place of power. Because if there's no place for you and I to agree on anything, then all I can appeal to then is power. That's why the old saying, justice is the interest of the stronger, emerges out of this very outlook. The concept of progress is shattered because there's no ideal toward which we ought to go. And community, as a result, dissolves. Now, one of the real proponents of a sort of postmodern relativistic view of these things is Kenneth Gergen. In his book, The Saturated Self, he says something I think very revealing. He says, now if selves are defined by their preferences, just arbitrary, I like this, I'm into this, this is what defines me, but these preferences are arbitrary, then each self constitutes its own moral universe and there's finally no way to reconcile conflicting claims about what is good in itself. All we can do is refer to chains of consequences and ask if our actions prove useful or consistent in light of our own value systems. All we can appeal to in relationships with others is their self-interest, likewise enlightened, or their intuitive sympathies. But where sympathy or already congruent values are not enough to resolve moral disagreement between ourselves and others, we have no recourse except for to withdraw from one another. And my friends, this culture is just increasingly alienated right along the lines of what's being described right here. It's because we are suppressing the very thing that we know to be true about ourselves and the common humanity that we share and a basic framework of human dignity and rights and all that stuff that we have just relativized, not even in the cultural level, but down to the individual level himself. I am the master of my own moral universe. And Gergen is quite right. That with that trajectory, it just means that all of us are just utterly and finally alienated from one another. I was just reading in the paper yesterday, actually, I don't read papers anymore, they don't exist, but whatever, a news outlet on the web made the point that a recent social study has been done of this question of friendlessness, which keeps coming up in the literature. And they're talking about millennials. That's a bunch of you guys here this morning. That's mid-20s to late 30s. 22%, and this is a pretty comprehensive study, and it's been kind of double-checked and triple-checked by others. 22% of millennials at the height of their social engagement, 22% say they have no friends. It doesn't get any easier after 38. Man, that's deep alienation. That is human beings suppressing the reality of our commonality in pursuit of individuality. And we are killing ourselves from that. Paul says what we all know to be true, and that is that we all have awareness, moral awareness. We have conscience, and that conscience is important because that conscience bears witness against us. You do something. I ripped a toenail off my little toe the other day. Ow, man, I didn't say it like that, said it differently, but it conveyed the same idea. Really hurt to rip that thing right off my toe. And I'm so glad that I felt that pain, because that pain was a warning signal. I better do something about this, right? Conscience operates in exactly the same way. Conscience is this faculty of the soul, which when it inflicts its pain, namely by an awareness of guilt or shame, things like that, the conclusion that we need to draw is, man, something's wrong here. That is something that God built into who we are. All human beings have this, and it's here to tell us, man, you've got a problem. On your dashboard is this flashing light, and it's like, and what do we do with that? Becomes really the central issue in our life. Some years ago, when I was working through school as a lab tech, I met a woman on the last night of her life, and she had come into the hospital, and she was in shock, and was barely coherent, and over the course of the hours ahead, went from incoherent to comatose, and ultimately she died. And it was a stunning thing for a 38-year-old woman like this, an otherwise perfect health. And what had happened was she had burnt her leg about a month before, and that burn had become infected. So she went to the doctor, and it hurt. And the doctor loaded her up with prescriptions for pain and also an antibiotic, and said to her, get back to me if this thing begins to spread, because that's a serious problem. Well, what she did instead was she killed the symptom. She took the pain meds and didn't feel any discomfort, and so therefore thought, I'm okay. But you know what? That's not the way reality works. And she died. And really, you know, that is something that we need to think about here. That's the role that conscience plays and our humanity. And we can try to numb ourselves to the pain that conscience brings to us, but it doesn't change the circumstance of our life or the ultimate accountability that we bear. Do you understand what I'm saying here? This is just a desperately important point. Our conscience accuses us or rewards us. It accuses us of our objective guilt, the fact that I've done wrong. And then subjectively, that I feel something existentially as a person. That's called shame, a sense of unworthiness. Now, I know, and I want to be quick to add, in our culture, there definitely are things like false guilt and shame that ought not to be there. I'll be the first to acknowledge that. I want to make that clear. When a child feels guilty because their parents are divorcing, that's not on that kid. It's not their fault. And so our conscience is just as broken and fallen as the rest of our lives, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't provide for us real insight into who we are. We can feel shame about a lot of things. You can feel shame because you didn't achieve a certain level of success in your career, or grades in school, or get the girl, or whatever it is that made you feel bad about yourself. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is a deeper awareness of my sense that I have failed crucially to do with in my actions, in my thought life, what I know to be right. And that becomes a problem for us that needs to be fixed, that needs urgent attention, because that's the kind of thing that drives the course of our life, either by trying to run from that impression, run from that awareness, numb it, kill it any way we can, or just utterly surrender to it. That's the condition of humanity. And then he goes on, he says, this is chapter 2, verse 1, he says, you have no excuse, everyone who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. Okay, now he's conceding ground, and he's saying, okay, let's think about this from the standpoint of you who do not grow up in some kind of a religious framework or whatever, where you've got a moral God and all that, where you just, you know, because we're moral beings, we just kind of, well, we have to make more, we operate in moral categories, make moral decisions, stuff like that. And he says, even you, no excuse, because you're condemned by your own affirmations. No excuse. What do we mean by this? A couple of things. First, the fact is that everyone makes moral judgments. They're inescapable. Here's the 1990s moral judgment. Mean people suck. That was the bumper sticker that was just, you know, on all of the cool cars back in those days where Xers were in control of what culture meant. But it kind of brings out this point that, you know, everyone's operating from some kind of an evaluative context, and maybe that context, and certainly that context involves things like consent in sexual relationships, protection of the vulnerable, inalienable rights, things like that. We may not know where they come from, but we certainly recognize that they exist. And what Paul is saying here is that everybody operates on moral categories, and then very importantly, everyone fails even by their own standards. Let's think about it. Think about, what does this mean? Meaning people suck? Who would say such a thing? A sucky person, obviously, right? That's a cruel thing. That's a mean thing to say. So your very principle, you're guilty of. I'm sorry, my friends, but every one of you is guilty by whatever standard you want to bring out. You're inconsistent in that way. You are, in the words of the Bible, a hypocrite. As am I. But that's the point. No matter what standard we bring to bear, you're guilty of it. And Paul just brings that out in such an important way, because he's trying to say this voice that God has created in your soul to alert you to what the way reality is, no matter what you believe, is telling you something critical you need to know. You're accountable because you violate this very standard that you know to be true. Well, you say, yeah, I don't suck that bad, though. I mean, there are people who suck way more than me. And so what are we doing here? This is the slippery slope into self-righteousness. Religious people are not the only self-righteous out there, which is namely everybody. We're always comparing ourselves to others and saying, I must be okay because I don't suck as much as that person does. Right? In our minds, in our hearts, when we're honest, we realize it doesn't matter how much that other person sucks. I know I suck. And that's a problem for me. Their suckitude makes no difference to my suckitude. I've got the problem. All right? You with me? Let's move on. Because then Paul says, okay, here's the other thing. If you bear the name Jew and rely on the law and boast in God and know as well and approve the things that are essential, being instructed by the law, and are confident that you are a guide to the blind, a light in the darkness. Listen, he's just dripping sarcasm on this. You're confident that you're a guide to the blind, a light in the darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having the law, the embodiment of knowledge and truth. You who teach one another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one should not steal, do you steal? You who say that no one should commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law through your law breaking, dishonor God. And now he's talking right to the heart of the religious person. What is he saying? A couple of fairly important things. To the followers of the religious law, he says, there is a pretense of moral superiority because, after all, I'm following these rules, and therefore, you know, I must be basically okay because, hey, I'm not stealing or killing, and so I must be pretty much okay. But that doesn't really probe to the heart of the matter. Jesus put it like this. He says, what sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites, he says. You are careful to tithe, give 10% of the tiniest income from your herbs, but ignore the more important aspects of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. And that's, of course, why Jesus gave stories like the Good Samaritan and things like that, to show that the outward obedience of the religious person bears very little resemblance to what's going on in their heart, about which their conscience needs to become awakened. The law, Jesus says, is summed up as the Old Testament itself taught in Leviticus. Love the Lord your God with your total being and your neighbor as yourself. To put the real needs of others above yourself. To sacrifice for their interest. That's a little bit different than just staying out of trouble and avoiding problems and avoiding problematic and messy and confusing people. And the religious person can sear their conscience by outwardly performing in such a way that they are just unable to access the fact that inwardly they're full of all kinds of envy and bitterness and resentments and a fundamental lack of real love for other people, a lack of awareness of the responsibility that they have to be servants of another. And Jesus just says, you know, that's hypocrisy. And I think all too often that's a problem that we face as a church in our witness to the world. Paul says in this same passage, you're so proud of knowing the law, but you dishonor God by breaking it. No wonder, and he quotes here Isaiah chapter 52, no wonder the Gentiles curse the name of God because of you. You're just like a walking advertisement for the God that you declare. And when people look at your life, they're like, that's not the kind of God I'm interested in any way. That, I think, is a very sobering thought. And that should sober all of us here this morning. You're a walking advertisement for the God that you worship. And so, you know, what does that look like in terms of your moral priorities? What does your conscience teach you? Well, the law's verdict is clear. If we want to come before God and our accountability and our justification is our performance by the law, what does the law say? The law says in verse 20 of chapter 3, by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. So two things here. By the works of the law, no flesh will. He's just saying, I gave you the law, but none of you can. It's like giving a test that you know no one can pass. Do you want to know what accountability looks like? God says, okay, here's the law. Thump. How are you doing with that? Well, not so well. James tells us, he says, whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point has become guilty of all. We think, well, I didn't break that much of the law. So, have you ever gotten a lease on an apartment? I've had a lease on an apartment before. Kind of long, a lot of fine print. In it, though, is a whole list of things. You know, you got to pay your rent by the first week of the month. You can only have X number of people living in the apartment. No pets. Fourth point, no pets. Fifth point, no pets. No open fires in your house. Noise ordinances, all this kind of stuff. Big list of stuff. You say to yourself, okay, no problem. And but then, you know, your lawyer, or your landlord comes to your door, pound, 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 pound. He says, you're out of here. I'm evicting you. And you're like, why? And he says, well, because you haven't paid rent in 3 months. And you're like, well, but I've done everything else. And like, that doesn't matter. You broke the lease. Doesn't matter how many times or in what severity. That was the standard agreement. And you blew it. Out. Okay? And the same thing works for the law. He's not saying, I hope that you can kind of do better than not, you know, more better than bad or whatever. That's not the standard. If you break a clause in the contract, you broke the contract. Don't try to convince your conscience that you're doing your best and it's really okay because it's not that bad. Look at the law. What does the law say? The law says you're guilty. In fact, that's the purpose of the law. That's the last point. Through the law comes knowledge of sin. That's right. God gave us the law not to make us better, but to help us understand here's where the real problem lies. That's the purpose of the law. So we end with this. It's all very depressing. What are we supposed to do? We sit here, we're bleeding all over the floor. We're saying, oh God, I'm guilty. You know, I realize that no matter how I try to justify myself, I find that I am guilty. If I put up my own standards, I violate my own standards. If I put up God's standards, I violate them as well. And I know that the universe, if it's to be just, there has to be accountability. And that's the problem that we face. So we have really walked through a couple of fairly depressing weeks to make this point. But we're doing it for the very important reason that there is good news. Right in this passage, Paul says, don't you see how wonderfully kind, tolerant, and patient God is with you? Does this mean nothing to you? Can't you see that it is the kindness and the kind intent of God for you to turn you from your sin? That's the point of this, is not to drive us into despair and make us feel all bummed out and blue. It's really for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is to cry uncle. I don't know if they still do this. Back in the day when I was in elementary school, the bigger kids, the stronger kids, usually the older kids, like to dominate the younger kids, which namely were people like me. And so out at recess, the big guys would grab the little runts, throw them to the ground, put their arms behind them, and start pushing up, and they'd say, "Cry uncle, cry uncle, cry uncle." And if you said uncle, then they would let you go. Is that a thing? That's not a thing, apparently. Wow. Maybe they do something different now. I don't know. But that was my initiation into manhood. Here's the point. All God wants you to do is cry uncle. Just to say, I cannot escape the evidence of my conscience, the accusations of my conscience. The real pain here really is just surrendering our pride to say what really is true. Because once we do that, which is what he means here, turning from your sin, in a lot of our translations, it's the word repent. It means to change our minds. It's just simply to say, I choose, God, to agree with you. I'm done being a self-righteous hypocrite, no matter what my background is here. You can be a totally agnostic, non-practicing religious person who is a self-righteous hypocrite, because we all are. And just to acknowledge that to God, I don't meet your standard, and I give up this project of self-justification. And I throw myself on your mercy. And if you can come to that place in your heart and in your mind, then you're going to find these next 2 months together, as we roll out how God deals with that broken situation, to be the most profound and life-transforming moment of your life. These are the truths that change us. These are the truths that transform and bring a sense of joy and healing and restoration and vitality into our lives. And so I'm asking, come on back. Because the bad news is worse than you could have ever really thought, but the good news is just vastly greater than you can imagine. And we want to build an understanding of how God deals with this broken state of humanity. How he alone provides the resources for broken, lost people who fail at the court of accountability before God to turn them into his sons and daughters and to restore them to a kind of dignity beyond belief. Because of the time, I'll just close this in prayer. Lord, just thank you for this time to be together. And we really do believe that weighing in on the things that are uncomfortable, well, is uncomfortable. But at the same time, necessary if we're to walk in the light, if we're to really take account of what our own conscience is telling us, that puts us in a place where we've got real problems, and we want to acknowledge that the problems are bigger than the resources that we have to fix, and that puts us in a place, Lord, where we're looking to you and asking, God, that you would make clear to us as we really continue this study to make sense in a personal way, in an intellectually satisfying way, what is this gospel? What is this good news? And just thank you, Lord, that you have not left us in the dark, but that you've revealed yourself to us through your word and through your son, and in an ongoing way through your spirit. And so we just thank you for these things in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.